What is it about our culture, about our economic, political, and social institutions which are generating such widespread drug involvement? Well, cocaine was anywhere, everywhere, and legal. It was in every patent medicine. You know, door-to-door salesmen would come around. In fact, there was a syrup that was given to teething infants that had, in fact, opium in it. Society that's in distress, mm-hmm. a society that has lots of problems, mm-hmm. that don't appear, where solutions don't appear on the horizon, it's very temporary.
Frank and I are extremely pleased to have our good and longtime friend Jack Schierenbeck back with us today on Alternative Views. Jack was active in our show from 1978 to 1981, and since leaving Austin in New York City, he's worked as a journalist, writing for various newspapers and magazines. He's worked as a lecturer, and most recently he's been working in a drug treatment center in New York City. Today we're going to talk with Jack on the problems of drugs in society, talking about some of his experiences as a drug counselor and some of his analyses and perspectives on the problems of drugs and society. So Jack, welcome back to Alternative Views. Great to have you here.
Well, it's nice to be back. I have been watching your show, Alternative Views, up in New York City on the CUNY station. It's on four times a week up there. Very good. And I've been watching you guys age as time goes on here.
This happens.
Well, so am I. I guess it's the ravages of time and Haagen-Dazs.
Speaking of ravages, you know, we got this big war on drugs. It's got to be a war on something or other going on. So you are, so to speak, as a drug counselor in New York City, you're in the trenches. So can you say something trenchant about the war on drugs?
Well, actually, I'm not really in the trenches. I think I'm in the MASH unit. I'm more than a foot soldier, I'm a medic. And one of the things, the first thing to start out with is, I think we need to 86 this idea of the war on drugs. I think it's part of that way of conceiving the problem is part of the problem rather than the solution.
As a military type of thing.
It's the military
metaphor. Have enough troops against it, then you can wipe it out.
Well, what do you want? In a war, you look to defeat the enemy. First of all, we have to analyze what is the enemy. I think that, you know, being an old, trained as a political scientist, I remember that George Orwell wrote a great essay in 1948, I think, Doug, Politics and Language.
Right.
In it, he cautioned that be mindful of the language that you use because it shapes how you think about social problems. And I think there's something about the war metaphor that reveals something about the American character. It says that, you know, our first instinct is to reach for the gun. And I think what we need is understanding of this problem. I think we need to be looking at not the tactics of how to win the war, but what are the underlying assumptions of this war? And I think that we don't get that much of it in the press. I think for the most part we get just discussions of tactics and not really what are the basic assumptions behind this effort.
It's such a complex subject. You have everything from the junkie in the street to the pushers to the big, like the cocaine cartels down in Colombia, to the CIA involved in drugs, right on up through the White House administrating some of this. And also the use of the drug war to try to curtail civil liberties. There are the medical aspects. It's so complex. Where do you start trying to get a handle on this drug problem?
Well, I think one of the first things you do is to understand that from my perspective as somebody who works in the field, we don't see it as the drug problem. We see it as a drug symptom. When someone comes to us, and as a social worker, you do, the first time you see them, you do a very in-depth intake, where you get their history, their life history. You do that because you implicitly understand that people don't use drugs accidentally. They use it because it makes sense within the context of their lives. And so I think what we need to do is look what we do with addicts. What we do in a 12-step in Alcoholics Anonymous, in Narcotics Anonymous, what you do is you're asked to take, in one of the steps, you're asked to take personal inventory and to write down your character defects. Hmm. Well, we as a society need to take that same inventory and to write down our defects. What is it about our culture, about our economic, political, and social institutions which are generating such widespread drug involvement?
Well, Jack, let's begin with that topic. In your experience as a counselor, what is it, do you think, that drive the people to drugs that you deal with?
Well, it's really complicated. It's extremely complicated. Let me first of all say that it's not really it's sort of provocative to say drugs are not the problem, but they're the symptom. Mm-hmm. But there's really no consensus about what this it's a symptom of what.
Right.
Let's take, for instance, conservatives. Conservatives think it's a symptom, too. They think it's a symptom of a decline of personal responsibility, of morals, of basic permissiveness. Our new drug czar, William Bennett, is one of his favorite targets is the 1960s as a time of permissiveness. He'll say, well, this is what happens. You get drugs when you have a society that says, if it feels good, do it, or do your own thing. And he says that basically the present drug problem can be traced back to the 60s. Actually, you know, William Bennett is a smart guy. He's got a PhD right here from UT.
Right, from our philosophy department.
Right, and he's got a law degree from Harvard. But he really ought to be a better student of history, because the actual roots of, at least in our own country, go farther back than the 1960s. In fact, we can trace it back to the 1860s. The first addicts in the United States were Civil War veterans, many of whom were racked with battlefield wounds. Remember, medicine was extremely crude at the time. You get a gunshot wound, they'd lop off your arm or your leg. And a lot of these fellas were just in extreme agony when the war was over. Well, the hypodermic needle had been invented in 1857, and they found out that you take a little morphine in the syringe, in the hypodermic, and you got some relief. So the first addicts, in fact, were morphine addicts, Civil War veterans. But it shouldn't stop there. In fact, when we talk about cocaine today and the cocaine epidemic, by the way, I really don't use terms like epidemic. I really think that in many ways the idea of drugs being contagious, and it also gives the feel that, you know, people are somehow tainted. So I usually shy away from that. But the first time that cocaine appeared on the scene was, in fact, in the 1880s in the United States. Coca-Cola, the active ingredient in Coca-Cola, from 1886 to 1905, was cocaine.
Right. Well, Freud thought it was going to be the solution to mankind's problems. Well,
absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
Nietzsche was a cocaine addict, too, for pain.
Well, cocaine was anywhere, everywhere, and legal. It was in every patent medicine. You know, door-to-door salesmen would come around. In fact, there was a syrup that was given to teething infants that had, in fact, opium in it at the time. And it was called Mrs. Swanson's or something, soothing syrup. And of course you put that on the gums of the infant, and yes, it would certainly stop crying because it would be in oblivion. And you found opium, you found cocaine, you had marijuana use. Remember, most people aren't aware of, the United States was the last Western country, Western Europe included, to enact narcotics laws. That was in 1914. And we had the odd, ironic situation in the 1920s where alcohol was illegal and marijuana was legal.
Well, look, now, if there was such widespread availability and use of all these potent drugs during the... Why wasn't the whole country bladdered out of its mind and having all these problems that we have today?
Well, actually, if you read the text of the times, if you read books and accounts of the times, it was a really serious problem. In fact, David Musto, a psychiatrist historian at Yale, has documented in a book called The American Disease, where he traces that history. And there were real serious problems. It was not limited to just poor. I mean, there was a history of of black workers being given cocaine by their bosses in order to get more work out of them. You also had very, even the high society, I don't mean that as a pun, in places like New York City and San Francisco, after a night on the town would retreat to opium dens in the Chinatown sections of New York and San Francisco.
As did the writers and the bohemians.
Exactly,
from that era.
So there were serious problems that were generating that, and at the time when it was understood there was a retreat from drug use.
But what about now? We've had alcohol use. I mean, centuries, millennia. You go back into the Bible or other old ancient publications, and they talk about people getting drunk. So we've had these psychoactive drugs, yep, whether illegal or legal, mm-hmm, ever since mankind has been.
I don't think there's no doubt about that. In fact, archaeologists have found in Egypt papyrus scrolls that talked about the first breweries in ancient Egypt being in 3500 BC. Before that, in ancient Sumeria, they used to use opium, which the word they used for opium was joy.
And that's one of the Greeks in the Eleusinian Mysteries had religious cults that used drugs, as do many traditional societies, mm-hmm, all over the world up till this day.
Yes.
So it's a prevalent
feature of any
society. So to blame it on the 1960s, as William Bennett does, is just absurd. It shows total historical myopia.
Well, Bill Bennett ought to know better. I'll tell you why he ought to know better.
I'm sure he does. He's just a propagandist, a right-wing ideologue like all the others.
Well, I think he's got his agenda. He's got his own agenda that he's pushing. But he ought to know better because Bill Bennett and I were born in the same place, and that's Brooklyn, New York.
Right.
And Bill Bennett knows that there was a drug problem growing up in the 1940s and 1950s in Brooklyn, New York. And that drug was alcohol. Well, I grew up in the Bayreuth section of Brooklyn. There were four bars on every block in 3rd Avenue and 5th Avenue. And there were churches on 4th Avenue. And the women went to the churches to pray that the men wouldn't drink. And the men went to the bars, and the women's prayers were never answered. So there was a drug problem then, but it was called alcohol, and it was legal, and it was socially acceptable.
And the churches were serving wine to go with their little wafers.
But, Jack, during these other periods, the so-called drug or alcohol problem didn't really surface into media attention. During September of this year, there was something like 260 media stories on drugs alone, on network television and the New York Times. Why this sudden focus on the drug problem? What does this signify, that suddenly drugs is a number one problem? Bush makes a speech talking about declaring a war on drugs. Bennett's going all over the country talking about drugs. Why now?
Well, I think that I'm not going to poo-poo the idea that that people don't use drugs and that, mm-hmm, there are not destructive consequences for them using drugs. I think that since Reagan came into office, drugs have been a convenient whipping post. Now, I think that there's an ideological agenda here to push. Mm. I think that in many ways drugs serve as a diversion from looking at other social problems. I mean, as I said before, people don't use drugs accidentally. If you look at their history, the people that come to see me often are coming from life situations which are really unbearable. I deal with probably 90% of the clients that I see in my work are minority women who've been referred from the child welfare agency in New York City because there have been reports or allegations that they use drugs. And that unless they agree to go to treatment or at least submit to an evaluation by me or people like me, their children are going to be taken away. And when you do the intake assessment, when you do their personal history, I mean, sometimes I look at them and I don't have any wonder why they use drugs.
Well, what are some of the common factors that drive people into drugs that you've experienced?
Well, obviously, poverty is one of them. Mm. I mean, you're talking about people who, You're talking about women who have, by the time they're 22, 23 years old, have three or four kids, mm-hmm. maybe by three or four different men, mm-hmm. who were themselves children of broken homes. And in all likelihood, they were physically, often sexually abused, certainly emotionally neglected and abandoned. Poverty is a key.
Race, I would imagine.
Well,
prejudice keeps people from getting jobs. And
well, actually, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, these are not people with a hell of a lot of opportunities in front of them. When you find yourself in your mid-20s with kids and you're living in a welfare hotel, you feel pretty trapped. And I guess to buy some, you know, some sort of temporary relief, drugs can do that. I mean, there's no mistaking, drugs deliver in the short term. Drugs are very powerful, they're pain relieving, they give people a sense of mastery, they give people a sense of competence, give people a sense of power, they're highly pleasurable, but they have long-term negative consequences. But if you're only living in the immediate, mm-hmm. if life doesn't look all that well down the road, can you blame them?
Jack, before we get into some of the long-term negative consequences mm-hmm. of drugs and what you've experienced mm-hmm. in this regard, can you talk a little bit about how drugs are also symptomatic of an American tendency to find solutions to problems through commodities? In other words, the drugs we read about on television, cocaine, crack, heroin, etc., are similar in some ways to Valium, to tranquilizers, sleeping pills, aspirin, any number of other drugs
yeah.
that are used in yeah. this society
yeah.
simply to relieve pain
yeah.
and to give relief that are legal. So isn't there a tendency in the
yeah.
society that advertising, the media,
yeah.
and just the culture in general reinforces that if you want to solve your problems, you take a drug. There's a commodity solution.
Well, I don't know to what extent I can add to that. That's mm-hmm. Was that a question?
I mean, don't you think that's the main, that people don't see anything wrong with this because it's part of the culture?
Well, I would say this.
Yeah.
No less than one of the fathers of our country, the fellow who penned the phrase, the pursuit of happiness,
mm-hmm.
is Thomas Jefferson. He also penned that the art of life is the avoidance of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I don't think we should, you know, when we talk about we're anti-drug and the war on drugs,
right.
I think first of all we should understand that drugs have a beneficial role to play in society, in our lives. It's made our lives, first of all, longer,
mm-hmm.
we're alive, and
mm-hmm.
healthier.
Mm-hmm.
All of us would not be alive today without penicillin and antibiotics
mm-hmm.
and aspirin and the various other even more or drugs that have kept us alive in, say, in emergency situations. So that's important to keep in mind. A drug is any substance which is psychoactive,
right.
which is can change mind or mood or body.
Right.
So, but what happens is I think in a society society that's in distress,
mm-hmm.
a society that has lots of problems,
mm-hmm.
that don't appear where solutions don't appear on the horizon, it's very tempting to look to substances that are just a swallow away from getting some relief.
But it's more than just this. People in the media and even what we've been focusing on now is the poor people in the ghettos who are trapped and they're in emotional pain and helplessness. But there are articles about the wheelers and dealers on Wall Street using cocaine. There are plenty of alcoholics who make a good living.
Yeah.
Now, and as we've seen, Homo sapien has been doing this of all classes for a millennia.
Yeah.
So what is there that's different?
Well, I wouldn't. There's a fellow, a researcher from UCLA named Ron Siegel, who's just written a book called Intoxication, The Search for Artificial Paradise, where his thesis is, he first looks at the animal kingdom, and then and traces it later into human beings.
Mm-hmm.
His thesis is that it's that the desire for intoxication, the changing of consciousness, is in fact built into the species. And and as a drug counselor, that's not a popular position to take. but I mean, that's all I can say is that in your point about poverty, Listen, two of the Kennedy kids had drug problems. David Kennedy killed himself from an overdose of, I believe, cocaine. Robert Kennedy was, when he was on the staff of Robert Morgenthau in the prosecutor's office in New York, was in fact arrested for possession of heroin. You have John Belushi, you have baseball stars, you have athletes, you have movie stars. You have Kitty Dukakis drinking rubbing alcohol because there was no booze left in the house.
Exactly.
So obviously it's not just a function. People's intake of drugs is not just a function of poverty. There are other stresses in life. I mean, there are stresses to stay at the top. You talk about Wall Street. I have friends of mine who work on Wall Street. Nobody pays you $150,000 a year unless you're willing to step over dead bodies in our culture. It's high stress. It's fast lane. It's very competitive. It's a world where you do never show your weaknesses to anyone. It's a world of rugged individualist.
Brutal and predatory.
Brutal and predatory instincts. That takes a toll on the spiritual and emotional health of a human being. And that's no wonder. I mean, today they're using cocaine, but historically Wall Street was always a place where people got wasted after work on alcohol. Now they generally mix the two. You know, you take the cocaine during the day to find the energy, the wherewithal to deal with the fatigue issues. And then after you get too wired up and racy, they have a few drinks in order to float back down to earth.
Jack, let's focus now on this question of drug abuse. Granted that all societies in history have had alcohol, drugs, and other things to relieve pain, to help people cope with stress and different problems. And granted also that a lot of drugs are useful to the human being. What then constitutes drug abuse? And then let's get into some of the destructive effects of drugs as you see them.
Okay. Well, we are, as a person who works in the helping profession rather than the police profession.
Right.
The police and law enforcement take a view that any use constitutes abuse.
Right.
We don't.
The law. Right.
We don't.
Right.
We take the view that we look at the context of a person's life and say, to what, when a dependency develops where the use has negative life consequences, then it becomes abuse in our mind. So that means we'll be looking at a person's emotional health, their physical health, their financial health, how they're getting along with their families, going to work, their money. That's essentially the distinction between use and abuse. In all societies, as you say, people have used drugs, but there is a markedly different effect that cocaine has on a Bolivian peasant who takes a coca leaf and begins to chew it.
Right.
First of all, it's spread throughout the whole body, and you end up getting about 5% of the potency of the drug. It's longer acting, and it has a way of, one, it curtails hunger, which is, of course, important in countries, third world countries, where people are starving or malnourished, and it has a way to help them work, and many of them have to work brutally long hours. But in our country, with the modern technology available and the processing of the drug, when you snort cocaine, you go from 5% that Bolivian peasants get to 85% of purity. Even better yet, if your idea is to get wasted, is either freebasing the cocaine, which is smoking it, or crack form, where you're getting 98% of the purity. Crack, within 5 seconds of your ingestion, goes right through the brain wall and activates the pleasure centers of the brain and gives you a power-packed 12 minutes where you're on Mount Olympus in terms of pleasure. Problem is, at around the 13th, 14th, and 15th minute, and getting worse, you start to feel withdrawal symptoms. That might be irritability, might be onset of depression, cravings, even paranoia. And what do you do? Well, most people, they get another $5 or $8 and take another hit. And so then they're on the cycle.
Of dependency, and here's where it becomes destructive for people's lives.
Extremely destructive.
Can you give some scenarios of lives being destroyed or some of the processes through which people are literally destroyed because of drug dependency?
Well, I mean, I don't know where to start. My clients are people who whose stories just are heartbreaking. You know, you have the young woman who came to me, who was 19 years old, and middle-class white woman, who her father, she was an only child, and her father had passed away from a heart attack when she was 14, and her mother died from cancer, long cancer, when she was 17. She was left the house. She sold the house for $125,000. And her and her boyfriend, in the space of less than a year, went through $125,000 in cocaine. Mm-hmm. When she came to me for help, I had to give her $5 to take a cab back home. One even more dramatic, I was telling you last night, we can let the audience know we were talking last night, and this story struck you guys, was the time that a man and wife came for help, and he was barefoot, and she was wearing his old floppy shoes. And I said, what's the story here? Why don't you have shoes? Why are you wearing his shoes? And she said, well, on the way over here, she sold her shoes for $10 so we could both get a hit of crack. Now, to me, that bespeaks a desperation that really tells a story about when the line is crossed between use and abuse. Mm. I mean, I have stories of people selling their babies' Pampers and diapers for money for drugs.
Plus, it throws other people into crime, which is another.
I mean, I'll give you another
prostitution.
I'll give you another example. A woman who lived in a welfare hotel. I mean, this really tells you the sort of ingenuity of some of drug dealers. Welfare in New York City, in welfare, you get a check once a month, and you have to go to an office to get it. So during the month, what would happen is if a drug dealer in a welfare hotel knows that a woman is getting public assistance, he'll take her card and hold the card, and he will give her drugs.
On credit.
On credit. And when they come back, when the time comes, they both will go at the turn of the month, they will both go to the welfare office to get the check. She will then immediately turn over the money to him. And he, of course, would have charged her double because you're paying double on credit. That's just a sample. I mean, we could go on for hours talking about the stories, the horror stories
well,
that I've seen.
Well, people's whole lives, then, are involved in getting money for drugs, using drugs, and then the aftermath, the down, dealing with the same cycle of anxiety, depression,
it's listen, it's a full-time job being an addict.
Right.
Full-time job.
So that's where it destroys your life. It just
clearly,
takes over.
It's completely single-minded, obsessional.
Okay.
I mean, you're looking at somebody who gets up in the morning. If you're a heroin addict, right, you get up in the morning, and within a very few hours, you're starting to get cold chills, sweats, diarrhea, vomiting. You've got to find some way to get the dope. So the first thing is you've got to find some way to get the money.
Right.
Okay. If you're lucky, you're a hook, a crook, or whatever you're going to do to get it, then you got to find somebody to cop the dope from.
Right.
You got to hope that it's good stuff and they're not giving you some garbage they've cut it with. Then you got to find a clean set of works, because if you don't get a clean set of works today, you can get AIDS in the bargain.
By works, you mean hypodermic
syringe, a cooker, mm-hmm, cotton, etc. You got to get the whole works. Then you got to find a place to shoot the dope.
Because you're on the street looking for all this
stuff.
Right,
and then you get a couple of hours of nirvana.
Right.
And then we begin the cycle all over again.
Right.
That's a full-time job.
And expensive. What does it cost an addict a day for heroin or crack?
Take heroin. There are people who survive on $50 a day in heroin. There are other people who use $200 a day with heroin. But crack, at $5 to $8 to $10 a pop, I know people who go on what is called, in the subculture that I work with, it's called a mission.
A mission?
Yeah, they'll say, I guess it's like George Bush said, it's my mission. Remember he said that on his...
Oh, right.
Well, they go on a mission where essentially they just leave it all, they go to the crack house, and they don't come up for air for 2 or 3 days.
My God.
And they'll go through $600 to $1,000 in that 2 or 3 days. Now, yes, where do they get the money? Well, any way they can. For women, often the bargain is sex. Mm-hmm. They trade sex for drugs. In the bargain, though, they get more than just the high from the drug. Many of the men who frequent the crack houses, in addition to smoking cocaine, also are intravenous drug users. Very popular today is to shoot cocaine and heroin together. It's called speedballing.
Why is that?
Well, you see, got to understand something about the pharmacology of the drug and its effect on the body. Cocaine is a stimulant, a very powerful stimulant, and it excites the part of the brain that's very much at the pleasure center of the brain. And you'll get very, very high. Problem is, the higher you get, the harder you fall. And what they've discovered is by putting heroin into the hypodermic, into the syringe, they've discovered that once you get way high up, in a sort of time-released way, the heroin begins to kick in right after, so you don't suffer withdrawal effects. You sort of parachute down to earth in the billows of a nice heroin cushion. So that the speedballing, the cocaine, and the heroin go together wonderfully for a lot of these fellas. They use the drugs that way. The women come in thinking that, well, these are guys that don't use IV drugs. They end up having sex with them. They end up going back to their partners, many of whom are unaware that they're using drugs or have gone to the crack house. They transmit it to their sexual partners. They have babies that have AIDS, and the babies won't live to see kindergarten.
To what extent is this one of the main problems in the drug culture, that is AIDS?
Absolutely.
Do you see much of this? Is this really prevalent?
Tremendous.
Okay.
Tremendous amount. The gay community should be absolutely applauded for what they've done. They have really cut it down to virtually zero increase in the gay community. Mm-hmm. Yes, you see people getting AIDS, but these are people who were exposed to the virus long before the publicity came out that there was a connection between unsafe sex practices and the HIV virus. Amongst the intravenous drug using, amongst the drug culture, there was almost no talking to them. We have attempted to, the New York City Board of Health, send people, they wade out into the intravenous drug abusing community, attempting to get them to use protected sex, if they're going to have sex, and it's virtually impossible. After all, remember these people don't have a long horizon. They don't think of life in terms of a long horizon. So, and they're very resigned and defeated to the idea that life is going to be very short for them. So to talk to them about safe sex and about not getting AIDS and not giving AIDS to other people, they've been a very difficult community to reach, and that's why you see such an explosion of AIDS in the intravenous drug-using community. And essentially that has been the bridge to the heterosexual community, because it's through the IV drug users and their partners that it gets into the heterosexual population.
Are they just fatalistic, the fact that, I mean, they all should know by now that if they share needles, they're liable to get AIDS, and yet they continue to do it? This short-term outlook, and they say, oh, well, what the
Well,
heck?
I think if you've been in the community a while, you're already exposed. I think they basically take the view that, you know, I've been shooting drugs for 5 years or 6 years or 3 years or 2 years, and I've already been exposed. So what am I going to worry about? The horse has already gone out of the barn here.
So they figure they have it anyway.
They're going to have it anyway, and they basically I think their view is I might as well enjoy what little life I've got left.
Jack, there are two drugs which cause more deaths than any of the illegal drugs, and those are the legal drugs found in cigarettes and tobacco products, and in alcohol. Can you give us an idea of the comparison of those two compared with the illegal drugs as far as the
dangers? Well, that's that's really interesting. When I go out into high school, I talk in high schools quite a bit, and I ask them one of my trick questions. Because I say, what are the most popular drugs in the world? And of course, they're used to hearing about cocaine and marijuana and PCP and angel dust and LSD and heroin and the like. And that's usually their answers. They're very surprised when I tell them the three most popular drugs in the world are alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine. Mm-hmm. They're very surprised. First of all, they don't think of those as drugs. After all, drugs are bad. And if they're drugs, what are we doing selling them? But you're right, Frank. I think your question hints at that we have a blind spot when it comes to nicotine and alcohol in this culture. People are also very surprised, considering the attention that's put on illegal drugs and how devastating and deadly they are, when they find out the statistics, that there's anywhere between 400 and 450,000 people die every year from alcohol and nicotine-related disease. You know, cancer, heart disease, emphysema, and the like. But 2 years ago, the statistics were totally less than 6,800 people died totally from direct effects of all the illegal drugs in the United States combined. So that means that more people die in 1 week from alcohol and nicotine-related disease than in 1 year from all the other illegal drugs combined. So one might ask, why is it that we have this double standard? I think you have to look at not only the politics, but you have to look at the economics here. You're looking at a multi-billion dollar industries of cigarettes and alcohol.
With great political influence.
As media influence. Yeah. Media glamorizes the use of tobacco, alcohol, etc., while it sensationalizes and villainizes in the news programs other drugs.
Yes.
So this is obviously part of the source of the double standard.
Well, I'm very glad that this... I mean, I'll tell you, as a drug counselor, I'm very glad that we do villainize and we do point the finger at nicotine and alcohol. I think it's extremely important. They are very dangerous. I think we are, as a society, getting away from glamorizing cigarettes. I mean, you can see it today. You go into restaurants, there's no smoking sections. You go on a plane, you can't smoke. I applaud these things. Right. But the fact of the matter is that we should understand. Partly our problem of focusing in on illegal drugs is that we forget that in one way or another, all of us buy into the drug culture. I say it sometimes when I'm out and talking to groups. You know, we have a society that's basically addicts are us. it's only by basically singling out and isolating illegal drug users that we don't understand how much we have in common. They have in common with the rest of us. Ask somebody who drinks 4 or 5 cups a day of coffee how they feel in the morning if they don't get their cup of coffee. They tell you they're going up the wall. Ask somebody who's trying to give up smoking how difficult it is to give up smoking. Those people are addicted. Mark Twain's famous line was when he was asked, have you ever tried giving up smoking? And he said, yes, thousands of times.
Well, the former Surgeon General said that was the most addictive substance.
Very, very powerful. Very, very powerful drug. But to continue on my point, it isn't just, the problem of addiction is not just those things which we ingest into our body. A lot of people are now beginning to see addictions in a much broader context. Are beginning to see, well, we're not only a society that is drinking and drugging ourselves to death, but it's also a society that gambles. And they're saying, listen, we couldn't just go to AA tonight or NA tonight or Narcotics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous. We could go to Gamblers Anonymous. If you have people before you who are a gambler and you ask them why they gamble, the real gambler will tell you, I don't gamble for the money, I gamble for the action.
Right.
Or as gamblers say, the juice. I know because I was once a compulsive gambler.
Really?
I was once a guy that at 21 years of age, I'd come out of a card game after being with a bunch of, you know, fat, balding, cigar-smoking, bad breath guys until 11 o'clock in the morning on a beautiful spring day playing cards all night long. And you know what I'd say? Where's the next game? It had a complete hook. It hooks into me. And I did it because I loved the juice. I loved that feeling of exhilaration and power that I used to get in gambling. And it was wonderful because I'd always feel a sense of mastery when I won, but I always had the ability to say I had bad luck when I lost. So it was a kind of convenient out. But I loved gambling. Gambling filled a hole in me. It was very much an addiction, and it was an addiction that suited my needs for excitement. I guess from my own profile, I'm an excitement junkie. There are a lot of people who are excited.
I like that phrase, filled a hole in my life.
Yeah.
This is what needs to be looked at. What in society drives people to gambling, to addiction, to drugs, to alcohol, to whatever?
To food.
To food.
To food. I mean,
to sports. To whatever is there.
There's no doubt about it.
There's something lacking in society. There's an emptiness and a hole in society.
That's terrific. Because I say to people sometimes, listen, the next time you go to the refrigerator late at night, I want you to take inventory. Are you going because you're hungry, or are you looking for something to eat because you're bored, mm-hmm. angry, lonely, or tired? A lot of people are not looking to feed a hungry stomach, but a hungry heart. A lot of people are bored, and they're angry, and they're lonely, and they're tired, and they're stressed out, and they're fatigued, and they look for comfort and consolation in the refrigerator. How many of us haven't felt better? I know I come away sometimes dealing with these addicts all day long, and I have to walk past the pizza place. Actually, I found out I don't have to walk past it, and now that's why I'm not going to the pizza place. But it would call to me. Like, Jack, come, I'm going to make you feel better. And, you know, for a while, it does make me feel better. So I was opting for, you people opt for food, people opt for gambling. Hey, we're also a society that the one addiction that people always applaud, and that's workaholism. You call somebody a workhorse, and they think you're giving them a piece of praise. Fact of the matter is people are working themselves to death, people are gambling, people are overeating. Hey, what's that phrase? Shop till you drop. When the going gets tough, go shopping. What do you think that's about? It's about your point, Doug.
Filling up.
We are trying to fill up. We have as a society, we've taken distraction to a high art. Now, what are we trying to distract ourselves from? I think drugs and these addictions fulfill legitimate needs in our society, which our society frustrates. I think we have a need for community, which in a very individualistic, a very every man for himself, dog-eat-dog, rat-maced society is not fulfilled. I think we have a need for community. I think we have a need to have a sense of belonging. Many of us don't come from families where we had a chance to belong. Many of us are deeply wounded from what happened to us in our family settings. That's a whole other story. It's a whole other story about dysfunctional families. I mean, I'm a radical. I grew up. I went to college. I never heard about a dysfunctional family, but I grew up in a dysfunctional family. My father was an alcoholic. What does that mean? Was he a stumble-down Bowery bum? Absolutely not. He took care of business. In fact, when he drank, he was a sort of happy-go-lucky guy. Problem is, when you caught him on the wrong end of a drunk, he was about as explosive and unpredictable as you could ever get. And as children, I can remember, like, when he'd come through the door, we'd all scatter like mice, because you'd had no idea what was going to face you. So I grew up in a very chaotic environment, a very unpredictable environment, a very explosive environment, where there was a lot of physical abuse. There was a lot of yelling and screaming and arguing. In fact, I like to tell people when I get to talking about this sort of thing, it's not pleasurable, but there were two emotions in my house. There was red-hot anger and ice-cold detachment. Coldness. Mm. In fact, I can remember as children, I'm the oldest of five children, I can remember all of us retreating into the television set to watch Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver and the Donna Reed Show, and thinking, how come our family is not like this? How come Dad doesn't act like this, and how come Mom isn't like this? And I thought, and as children, you're so vulnerable that you think something's wrong with me. Why doesn't Dad love me, you know, the way, you know, Ozzie loves David and Ricky? And it was, it leaves scars. Now, at this point in my life, 40 years of age, I have no rancor, bitterness towards my dad. My dad himself is the child of two alcoholics. Both of my grandparents were alcoholics. He had been physically abused as a child. He only passed on what he knew. We've always known that alcoholism and drug abuse run in families. It certainly has taken a devastating toll on my family. I said I'm the oldest of five children. One of my brothers, growing up in that kind of an environment, with all of the emotional baggage it is of being essentially a victim of almost wartime conditions. I mean, they talk about battered children, they really talk about the same syndrome as Vietnam veterans, post-traumatic stress disorder. It leaves you a sense of emptiness. It leaves you always tense. You're always feeling anxiety. There's always feelings of failure. There's extreme feelings of low self-esteem. Well, to deal with that, one of my brothers first got into marijuana, and later at 17, got himself into heroin. And he was a heroin addict for 11 years, as was his wife. And they lived a horror story of an existence.
Did they have children?
They had two children. Their children were taken away. They were unfit parents. They lived in the streets. You know, after a while, even families that are supportive basically have to cut you loose because they're pulling everybody down. You know, when they steal the furniture for the third time, when you come home and find the house empty, you know, when they do everything they can to feed their habits, you eventually have to cut them loose. My brother lived that life, and his wife lived that life for 11 years. Came home one day and said, I don't want to do it. I'm going to get myself in a methadone program. Methadone, he went on methadone for 6 months. It was very hard on his liver. He had hepatitis. You can get hepatitis, of course. Before you could get AIDS, you used to get hepatitis from sharing dirty needles. Now you get something much worse. And he got a methadone, and it was bad on his liver. He started spitting up blood. So he got off in about 6 months. He got off it because he got out of the neighborhood. Many of the neighborhood influences were very difficult. So he moved to South Jersey. He and his wife moved to South Jersey. They were raising their kids. They bought a house.
They got their kids back.
They bought a house. They beat the habit. My brother was drug-free for 5 years. He was healthy, 6'2", 185 pounds, a beautiful man. He was talking about early retirement. He had IRAs. He made $60,000 as a carpenter the last year of his life. Because the story I have to tell is he comes home one day from work, and he says, I haven't been feeling well. I've been feeling dizzy. So he went to bed thinking he'd be better the next morning. He got up, and he didn't. They took him to a hospital. They did a scan on his brain. They found that he had 5 tumors on his brain. They took a specimen of one of the tumors. He had lesions on the brain. And the specimen showed that he had AIDS, toxoplasmosis, which is the neurological disorder that you sometimes get when you have AIDS.
So it finally showed up after all those years.
After 5 years of being drug-free, it had been sitting silently incubating like a time bomb ticking away in his system. And I watched my beautiful brother, and it's painful to me to talk about it. He was 6'2 and 185 pounds. And in 10 months, he withered away to 75 pounds and died.
What happened to his wife?
Well, she's still alive. She's still alive. She is HIV positive. She has full-blown symptoms. But our understanding of the disease now, Frank, is a lot better. And she's been being kept alive with AZT and a number of other drugs that are keeping her alive. But she's lost a lot of weight, and she's a courageous gal. And a good mother to the kids.
What about your other siblings? You said
were they affected adversely too? Yeah. Well, I'd say they were about as adversely affected as you can get. I had another brother. I say had because my family album is in black borders. I had another brother who presented very differently. He presented himself as an American success story. Often happens when you come from dysfunctional and troubled families. You're driven to succeed.
Right.
In many ways to convince other people that you're worth something and to deal with your own feelings of self-worth and a failure. Well, he was driven to succeed. He was very good. He went to an elite Catholic high school in Staten Island, New York that I went to. He played football. He went away to Indiana University. He played some football there. He came back, he took the family business that was making $1 million a year and made it into $3 million a year of business.
Your dad's business?
My dad's business.
Uh-huh.
Took it to $3 million a year. He had a brand new BMW. He had a new house. He spent more on clothes in 1 month than you and I would spend in 5 years. I know, because I once saw an American Express bill for 1 month, $7,000, just clothes.
I haven't spent that much my whole life.
You look it, Frank. Thank you. my brother was into what some people would call a massive cover-up. To deal with these feelings inside of low self-worth, he wanted to do his best to convince other people that he was a success. And on the outside, he looked like an extreme success. But on the inside, he was that scared, lonely, angry, depressed, helpless 10-year-old growing up worried about whether his father was going to beat him. He never had dealt with that emotional baggage. He never had gotten to the bottom of that stuff. And he used to like to do exciting things. He and I had that, shared that characteristic. We were excitement junkies, right? He made me look like a piker. I mean, I gambled and I did a few things, but he really was, we're talking major league. He would skydive. He liked to jump out of airplanes. He'd drive motorcycles 80, 90 miles an hour. He'd gamble, and I mean gamble big time. I once watched him, you remember now, it's a $3 million business, so you can afford to do this at least a while. He once bet $50,000 on the Super Bowl. And I was with him in the room when he made the bet, and I watched the game with him. He lost the bet, and he never changed the expression on his face. My brother believed in always maintaining a cool exterior, putting up an I'm okay front. But you know, the only way you can do that was a little help from our friends. In this case, he used to take Valiums, like 6, 8, 10 a day.
God.
He used to take them, I guess, like lifesavers. I guess for him, they were lifesavers, he thought at the time. And that helped to, like, mellow him out, because he was obviously under a lot of tension. And on weekends, he would drink. Maybe a quart and a half of Stolichnaya vodka would be about his night's consumption. And one night, he was drinking with his friends, and he collapsed at the bar. They said, well, he's drunk. Let him sleep it off in the back seat of the car. They put him in the back seat of the car and left him there alone to sleep it off, sober up. But they unfortunately left him with his head back. And the body is a magnificent engine, you know, it's a magnificent tool. It knows when it has a poison and it wants to get rid of it. With his head back like this, he obviously, when he was unconscious, he threw up and it had no place to go. And he literally drowned in his own vomit. He asphyxiated. He choked to death. So in the space of 6 months, I lost 2 younger brothers, and I buried them both. Very sad.
Well, this shows that drug abuse is not just focused on the poverty-stricken and the people in dire consequences.
No. Emotional neglect is an equal opportunity destroyer here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll find people in the highest echelons of government and politics and the economy often abandon or neglect their children. After all, they're fairly driven people. They're people who work long, 60, 70, 80-hour weeks. As I talked about before, workaholism sounds fine, except you're neglecting somebody. You're neglecting your spouse. You're neglecting your children. And in many ways, you're neglecting yourself. If we are to grow as many-sided beings, we have to do more than just be single-mindedly obsessed with work or any other addiction, which happens in the addictive process. As I said at the beginning of the program, I'm a battlefield medic. And as a battlefield medic, I have to help people with the tools that are in front of me who come into my office literally bleeding. And so I have to help them and try to get them into treatment, try to get them into therapy, try to help their children get into daycare. I do what I can, but I always know that basically I'm fighting a losing battle. I just don't have enough resources at my disposal. I also know that I'm also helping people where the damage is, for the most part, already done. To me, I have another role, and it's a role that most people in the drug treatment world, in fact, most social workers, are reticent to play, and that's a role as a social and political activist, because we have to be thinking about how do we change social arrangements so that we don't have people using these kinds of drugs to such a destructive effect on their lives. And to me, the drug issue has radical implications for the rest of society from top to bottom. You're talking about poverty, you're talking about a redistribution of income. If you're talking about loneliness, you're talking about creating institutions where people can feel a sense of belonging. Remember, one out of every 5 Americans in the United States move every year. We really are a rootless, unconnected people. It's really a continuation of the great migrations from Europe, where we came, left our families and left our communities, came to America, and bought into a go west young man rootlessness. I think that's played a tremendous cost. I think we are, you know, as David Reisman wrote in 1960, a lonely crowd, or as Philip Slater wrote in the 1970s, The Pursuit of Loneliness. I think we're a lonely people. I think we often find solace. We also, in drugs and other addictions.
Join us next time for part two in the series on the drug wars. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We also can give you information on how to get some of John Stockwell's publications. We'd like to thank our crew people. Eric Eubank was our camera person. Lisa Funk, Don Harvey, and Donald Herman helped with the editing. And Kevin L. West was our audio person. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. A lot of people write to us, people who see Alternative Views in a lot of cities around the country. So if you'd like to contact us, please do. Bye.